You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
We often simply assume that when it comes to these questions of life and death, be it the beginning of life or often the end of life, that those who are trying to advance the agenda of what's usually called euthanasia, which is another word for mercy killing, in the name of mercy, that they have the science on their side. After all, wouldn't they have the science on their side if they really want what they say is death with dignity? Now, those are just the euphemisms for the death movement, the end-of-life death movement. But do they, in fact, have the science on their side? Do the claims that they make, both generally and about specific cases, hold up in the court of science and solid medicine? Welcome back to Issues Etc. It's part two of our series, Are Secular Progressives Anti-Science? Today, we'll take up the subject of euthanasia. Wesley Smith is our guest, senior fellow for the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism, and author of several books, including Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and The New Duty to Die. Wesley, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Several years ago, we spent a lot of time talking with you in the last days of the life of Terri Schindler Schiavo and her now infamous case. What medical lies were told about her and her condition that eventually led to her death?
Well, I think the biggest medical lie actually came after her death, and it wasn't a medical lie. It was the reporting by the media, which repeatedly said that an autopsy determined that she was in a persistent vegetative state when she died, and that's not what the autopsy determined. The autopsy determined that the condition of her brain was consistent with either a persistent vegetative state or what's called a minimally conscious state, and indeed that an autopsy could not determine whether she was in a persistent vegetative state because that is a clinical diagnosis and was not determinable upon autopsy. All they could show in the autopsy was that she had severe brain damage, which no one denied. Secondly, of course, the question with Terri Schiavo really wasn't a scientific question. It was a moral and ethical question. And a lot of times what we find in these issues, whether it's Terri Schiavo, euthanasia and assisted suicide, the embryonic stem cell research, human cloning issue, is that when people take an ethical and moral stand to stand up for the unique dignity of all human life, they are branded anti-science, when in fact science is incapable of answering the question, does human life have intrinsic meaning? That's not a scientific question. That's a philosophical question. That's a religious question. That's a moral question. And so what you often find are people who claim they've got the mantle of science on their side actually arguing about ethics and using the shield of science as a way to try to prevent the people who might disagree with them from making points. Because as we saw in the embryonic stem cell debate, if you said, wait a second, there's a different way to go here, we can find an ethical and moral way forward for regenerative medicine, you were branded as anti-science, and that embryonic stem cells were the only hope. Well, notice that there are no embryonic stem cell cures after all the yelling and screaming, but that the places where effective treatments are happening are in the adult stem cell field and the induced pluripotent stem cell field that does not destroy embryos. So often science is hauled out kind of as a crutch for people who aren't comfortable admitting that what they are making is a utilitarian or nihilistic moral argument.
I'm wondering about certain terms that get kind of tossed around. Sometimes it's just misuse by lay people, and sometimes it is pernicious use by scientists and medical professionals when it comes to the end of life. Terms like brain dead. There is a person lying in a bed. They don't seem to be conscious, but they're breathing on their own. They can be fed via a feeding tube, hydrated via a feeding tube. They're not in any immediate danger. They're not terminal in any sense. They're not dying, but we're told that their brain dead.
Yeah, brain dead was, in the Terry Schiavo case, was really misused in her situation. Brain dead is a medical determination that a patient has actually died because the brain and each of its constituent parts has had permanent and irreversible failure. Terry Schiavo was clearly not brain dead, although that term, you're right, was often used to describe her. She could breathe on her own. Anybody with who is brain dead cannot breathe on their own because there is no, the brain cannot send signals to the diaphragm to make it contract or expand. She was able to, her kidneys functioned and so forth and so on. She had certain rudimentary reflexes, and people who I trust who were in the room with her actually said that she did have responsive capacities. For example, there's that tape of her, the video of her when her mother comes in and says, "Hi, Terry, it's Mommy." And Terry Schiavo just looks at her with a big beaming smile on her face. And that was dismissed as a mere reflex. Well, why would there be a reflex of a big smile when a woman hears her mother's voice?
Other terms that ordinary terms that often get thrown in. I remember reading reports that Terry Schiavo was even terminally ill, that she was in the process of dying.
Well, it's so ironic. The only reason she was terminally ill is because they were taking away her food and water. She was not terminally ill. Her body was functioning. She needed what we all need, which is food, water, warmth, comfort, that kind of thing. And she was put in a hospice, which is supposed to be for people who were dying. But the only reason that she was dying is because they were taking away her food and water, which was delivered by a feeding tube, which is a medical intervention. So other than that, she wasn't dying and probably could have lived out a normal lifespan or close to a normal lifespan.
What should we know about that term that you mentioned before, persistent vegetative state? What does it really describe, apart from its ethical considerations? What does it actually describe, and why so often in the way these things are dealt with by the death with dignity advocates is that's basically another term for death sentence?
Yeah, this is a term that I really don't like. Whenever anyone calls a person who's got a severe cognitive impairment a, quote, vegetable, close quote, I really take umbrage because no human being is a carrot or a rutabaga. And that is often tossed around. And some people who would never use another pejorative to describe a human being that denigrates and dehumanizes, which is what that term does, will do so for people like Terry. The term was coined many years ago and is the medical diagnosis, which is why I used it. And to me, it's the only medical diagnosis of which I'm aware that contains a pejorative. But what it means is if somebody is in a PVS, that they are fully unconscious, meaning they do have, like, brainstem activities. They are able to often, not always, breathe on their own. They will have wake and sleep cycles, but they are not interactive in any way. But what's interesting is that, speaking of science, we have found that many people who were so diagnosed are actually conscious but unable to communicate. And we've seen studies recently with advanced screening where actually people who were thought to be in this unconscious condition, non-responsive, their brain fires as a normal person's brain would fire. For example, there was a woman who was told to imagine you're playing tennis, and her brain fired in a fashion that would if she were, say, watching a tennis match. At least 40% of the diagnoses of PVS, or as I call it, persistent unconsciousness, because that's what we're talking about, turn out to be incorrect. That later on people find that there is some responsiveness. Often it's very difficult because people in these kinds of impaired conditions will react very slowly. because they are an impaired condition. Or there's something called a locked-in state, which looks like a PVS, because the person is incapable of responding, but they are fully conscious. There's a woman named Kate Adamson who was like that, who people thought she was in a PVS. And during the Terri Schiavo case, she said, look, they took away my food and water, not to kill her as they were doing to Terri, but because she had a, they were doing some surgery on her. They gave her inadequate anesthesia, thinking she was unconscious, so she felt the surgery. Can you imagine that? And then because they were removing a bowel obstruction, she was unable to eat or drink for several days. And she wrote that that was actually more painful than being able to feel the surgery. So these are things, another lie about Terri Schiavo is that she couldn't possibly feel it. Well, if she wasn't in a PVS, she could have felt it. And she wasn't receiving palliation. In fact, her husband wouldn't even let her have ice chips put in her mouth. So there is a lot of misinformation about this. There's a lot of fear about this because, you know, this is a situation that many people would worry about being in, and of course, nobody would ever want to experience it. And there's a lot of desire, for example, you talk about science and bioethics. There is now a lot of advocacy in the bioethics journals and the organ transplant journals to not require, this isn't happening, I want to hasten to point that out, but there's a lot of advocacy by very prominent and very influential people to do away with what's called the dead donor rule in organ transplant medicine, which requires that a patient be actually dead before donating a vital organ. They want to make it so that people like Terri Schiavo can be harvested. And that's, of course, not a scientific question. That's a moral and ethical question, because there's no question somebody like Terri Schiavo is alive. So what these advocates say is that, well, she may be alive. They don't necessarily talk about her personally, but I'm using that because people understand the condition she was in. But she is not a person, or somebody in that condition is not a, quote, person, close quote, because they are incapable of certain cognitive functions. And therefore, there is a denial of the intrinsic dignity of human life when bioethicists and doctors in organ transplant journals say that being a human being is morally irrelevant. What matters are capacities. And that leads to invidious discrimination and could lead to treating human beings, living, breathing human beings, as if they were a mere natural resource.
Wesley Smith is our guest. It's part two of our series, Are Secular Progressives Anti-Science When It Comes to the Subject of Euthanasia? He's senior fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism and author of several books, including Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and The New Duty to Die. More with him after this.
Seasons don't fear the reaper, nor do the wind, the sun, or the rain. We can be like they are. Come on, baby, don't fear the reaper. Baby, take my hand. Don't fear the reaper. We'll be able to fly. Don't fear the reaper. Baby, I'm your man.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's Classical Christian Curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Christmas is a holy day, not just an ordinary holiday. It's when we celebrate the birth of Jesus Christ, our Savior. That's why Emmanuel Press keeps Jesus as the focus of all their Christmas cards. And that's why they use the words of Scripture and the poetry of hymns inside the cards to confess our hope in Christ. Visit their website at emmanuelpress.us to see a variety of cards, including a brand new card for 2016. EmmanuelPress.us.
Smartest listeners in radio. You're listening to Issues Etc.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Do you dread going to work out?
Performance Fitness in Edwardsville offers a fun, supportive, tight-knit community and environment. Visit them on the web at performancefitness618.com or call 618-692-5063. Performance Fitness is the facility in the St. Louis Metro East where the focus is on member results, not membership numbers. 618-692-5063 or performancefitness618.com. Performance Fitness of Edwardsville.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Wesley Smith is our guest. Part two of our series, Are Secular Progressives Anti-Science? Today the subject is euthanasia. I'd like to ask you about how we should rightly understand, and sometimes these are severely misrepresented, even by medical professionals, terms like life support. Let's start with that one.
Life support, I'm not sure that I've seen a whole lot of misrepresentation about that term. Life support would be the kind of thing you would see in an ICU. Respirator would be an example of life support. The various kinds of, they'll give people various substances to help in terms of life support. A feeding tube is sometimes called life support because, of course, without it, if somebody can't eat and swallow, without a feeding tube, they will die. That one has not, in my experience, been terribly misrepresented.
What about things like someone is terminal or someone is in a critical condition? Usually we just hear something like that. These things seem to suffer mostly from being ill or underdefined.
Well, a terminal condition, the way it's generally used in terms of hospice and in terms of the assisted suicide laws in this country, is somebody who is expected to die within 6 months, even with treatment. But, of course, this is not a precise definition because people don't die by the numbers. And quite often, people are diagnosed as being terminal in all good faith and actually don't die of the condition with which they're diagnosed. I, for example, have a friend who was given 3 months to live with lung cancer. It was an advanced lung cancer. There'd been metastases to the brain and so forth. That was about 12 years ago, and he's still kicking. So that's not a precise term. It's a general estimate. Now, if you get to a situation in advanced stage of dying, you know, it becomes more precise. But the further you're out from the time one is expected to die, the less precise and certain that diagnosis is. And generally speaking, if you have a condition that most of the time leads to death, you're sometimes called terminally ill.
What about, and you have used the term, this is not so much perniciously used as maybe confused with other things, palliative care.
Palliative care is a pretty broad terminology. What it means is we're not talking about curing somebody. We're not talking about extending their life. What we're talking about is alleviating symptoms and alleviating suffering of various kinds, whether it's physical or whether it's existential. So in a hospice circumstance, and palliative care can be beyond hospice, by the way, professionals will often come into the home, and not only will they control the patient's pain, but they will control other symptoms such as agitation. There will be spiritual guidance with chaplains and so forth if that's what a patient wants, social services and this kind of thing. In fact, the last several months culminating in August, I had my mother in my home as she was dying, and we had hospice. And it was a tremendous service to people. You know, this assisted suicide issue and euthanasia is being sold on fear that people will be allowed to die in agony. And hospice is the antithesis of that. And in fact, the founder of hospice, Dame Cecily Saunders, she was a United Kingdom doctor who created the modern hospice movement. The amount of suffering her work alleviated can't be quantified. And I had the great honor to interview her for my book, Culture of Death. And she was adamant against assisted suicide because she said it denied the intrinsic dignity of her patients, and she's absolutely right about that.
Somebody says, Wesley, look, these hospitals, they have
ethics boards, and the guys right. have white coats, and they got medical degrees. Does that necessarily qualify them to render sound ethical decisions or policies?
Well, that's a very important point, you know, because somebody is a doctor, and we're dealing with issues that deal with values. For example, whether to refuse life support. That's not a medical decision. That's a values judgment. And, you know, the doctor may have one set of values and the patient may have another set of values. You know, a patient should not gainsay a doctor. Like if a doctor says, okay, you have an appendicitis. I mean, I'm not saying you shouldn't get second opinions, but that's a medical scientific determination. Whether or not you should receive the surgery, which most people would, obviously, but that's not the medical determination would be if you don't receive the surgery, your appendix will burst and you will die of sepsis. But whether or not somebody wants that invasive procedure is up to the patient, because that's a value judgment. So if somebody said no and they were competent to that appendectomy, they would be permitted to say no, because that is up to them whether or not they want that invasive procedure. You see that more often. That example is kind of a wild one. But you see this paradigm come up much more often in questions of things like you talked about, whether to stay in an ICU, whether to stop trying to fight the cancer but go into the hospice care and this kind of thing. Those are value judgments, and they're important value judgments. They're not scientific determinations.
You use the term competence there with about a minute. This is often a big problem when it comes to assisted suicide or the right to die. There are people who are making these decisions who may, in fact, not themselves be currently competent. What are your thoughts with about a minute?
You know, but the laws, they talk about competence in the advocacy, but the laws don't use that term. They use capability. And what that generally means in assisted suicide laws is the ability to communicate what they want in terms of assisted suicide. California, which just legalized assisted suicide, passed a regulation, speaking of competence, where people who have been involuntarily institutionalized for mental illness, if they are diagnosed with a terminal condition, can petition the court to be released to commit assisted suicide, not because they've been cured of their mental illness, but to be made dead. And so by definition, if you are involuntarily institutionalized, you are incompetent. Otherwise, you couldn't be voluntarily institutionalized. And you're also receiving very strong psychotropic drugs. So we are moving towards allowing assisted suicide for the incompetent. And in Belgium and the Netherlands, where euthanasia is permitted, they are now killing mentally ill people. Psychiatrists are euthanizing mentally ill people, and they're conjoining it with organ harvesting. It's a terrible, terrible, wicked thing.
Finally, with only about 20 seconds, is science on the side of the advocates of death with dignity or euthanasia?
No, because science really isn't, that's not a scientific question. It's a moral and ethical question. And that's where the battle must be joined, on the level of subjective morality, ethics, religion, and so forth.
Wesley Smith is Senior Fellow at the Discovery Institute Center on Human Exceptionalism and author of several books, including Forced Exit, Euthanasia, Assisted Suicide, and The New Duty to Die. You'll find a link to this book and to Wesley's columns under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Thanks, Wesley.
Thank you, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we'll have Pastor Ted Giese review the movie Arrival. We'll find Christ in Psalm 146 with Pastor Brian Ketchelmeyer. And it's This Week in Pop American Christianity with Pastor Chris Rosebrough. LCMS Life Ministry is devoted to upholding the sanctity of human life, both in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod and in the culture at large. You can find out more about their pro-life resources, including their annual Life Conference, January the 27th through the 29th in Washington, D.C., at lcms.org/life. That's lcms.org/life. It is very important that we don't let a white coat and a medical degree snow us into thinking that the decisions made are either good science or good ethics. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Daily worship, historical hymnody, and catechesis, interwoven with direct instruction in phonics, traditional math, literature, grammar, history, Latin, and strings. It's part of our daily life at St. Paul Lutheran School in Hamel, Illinois, the only classical Lutheran school in Greater St. Louis. We're located 1 mile off Interstate 55. For more information, visit school.stpaulhamel.org. We would love to share our joy in learning with your child. school.stpaulhamel.org.